This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Dr. Jinx Coleman-Broussard, LSU Mass Communication Professor. Her latest book, African American Foreign Correspondence, appropriately from LSU Press, focusing on the likes of Leon Dash and Howard French and William Worthy Jr. We'll talk with Jinx Coleman-Broussard, who also has a long history in Louisiana politics. C.B. Forgotston, speaking of politics, Capitol Watcher renowned. He'll be with us to talk about what's going on in Baton Rouge and beyond as Governor Bobby Jindal has finished his sixth regular session with mixed reviews. We'll get the take from the former chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee, Mr. Forgotston. All this, now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and our guest in studio is Dr. Jinx Coleman-Broussard. If you'd like to call, 297-5633 is the local dial outside our area. Please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Dr. Jinx Broussard is a graduate of the School of Mass Communication at LSU, and your PhD is actually from where?
The University of Southern Mississippi.
And she has been on campus at LSU for well over a decade, and she goes back some years, the first African-American to earn an undergraduate degree in journalism from LSU.
That's correct.
And appropriately, a member of the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame. Her book is African-American Foreign Correspondence. Before we get to the topic at hand, my guess is when you were attending the old war school, there weren't a whole lot of people of color on campus.
In fact, there were quite a few people.
Really?
Not quite a few people, hardly any people of color. That's what I should have said. You could almost count us on one or two hands.
Wow. Probably less than 100 people.
I think my freshman class had 200 blacks out of about 2,000. But 4 years later, only 10 of us graduated. 4 years later, 10 people. Eight females and two males.
Well, you went on to great things in public relations, working as the press secretary to Mayor Sidney Barthelemy in New Orleans. Were you with him the full 2 terms?
Yes, I left about 3 months before his term ended, but for the entire term, I was there.
Now, there's a man who was in government at the highest levels in this state. Mayor of New Orleans is pretty heady stuff. Some say it exceeds the governorship of Louisiana, and he just kind of went off into the sunset.
He did. Sidney's main objective in being mayor of New Orleans was to serve the people. He wasn't really interested in making a name for himself. He just wanted to do a good job and to help people in the city. So, you know, it stood to bear that he would leave and go to work somewhere and continue to try to serve people.
And 21 years ago, Jinx Broussard was the press secretary for Bill Clinton and Albert Gore in Louisiana as they were running for president and vice president. And they carried Louisiana, probably because of Jinx Broussard.
Well, I like to think I had something to do with it, along with Carol Spear and Jim Nicholson and a lot of people who worked really, really hard. But I tell you, we were ready for everything that was thrown at us. In fact, C-SPAN even made note of the work that we did in Louisiana in terms of rapid response. And that was way before the digital age.
What did you have to respond to rapidly?
Well, President George Bush had sent Bill Clinton letters touting his education reform in Little Rock and in the state of Arkansas. So the president, this was about 2 or 3 days before the election, and President Bush was scheduled to come to Shreveport. So James Carville and George Stephanopoulos sent to us via Delta Dash copies of the letters that President Bush had written to Bill Clinton. I immediately wrote a press release about it. We picked up the letter, Carol Spear and I, and drove to Shreveport and talked about how Bush had praised Governor Clinton for his foresight and for his actions to make Arkansas a better state. And we distributed those letters in the Bush White House filing room at the airport in Shreveport. Uh-huh. And so Bush had come there with a particular message, but instead the Clinton-Gore team stepped all on that message. I did a press conference or an interview right in front of Air Force One, and Carol Spear went on television at 5 o'clock to lead the news with rebuttal of what President Bush was now saying about Bill Clinton. And so about a week after the election, I was watching C-SPAN, and the people on the show talked about the fact that we had stepped all over President Bush's method and wondered how we were able to get into a Republican gathering, let alone into the White House press filing room and distributing press releases.
How about that?
So I don't tell that story that often. I was very, very young then, and I was doing what it took to get our message across.
Well, Bill Clinton is the last Democrat to win a presidential election in Louisiana, Arkansas. He carried some states that are not in play any longer. Do you think Louisiana will go to a Democrat in our lifetime in the presidential election?
I've given that thought, and the way things look right now, it would have to be the right candidate, and a lot of things would have to come together for a Democrat to be able to cover the state. So that's not to say that won't happen. Those things might come together fairly quickly, given what's been happening with our budget, with cuts to education, with cuts to health care. These are the kinds of issues that Democrats really need to be able to talk about and to show people how their lives mm-hmm. can be better without those kinds of policies that are in place right now. So given the right candidate with the right message and the ability to get that message across and reach people to let them know how policies impact them at their mm-hmm. home level. You know, you hear people say, keep the government out of my pocketbook. We don't want the government help. The government should stop helping those people. But now we see that those people might be parents of handicapped children. Those people could be the doctors and nurses who were at Earl K. Long Hospital that's now been closed. So I think the message will be, how do these policies impact you? Let's stop talking about political ideology, and let's talk about what impacts you in your pocketbook, what impacts you in your private lives, rather than repeating talking points on either sides. Because I tell you, it really gets to me these days, and I won't say get to me in a negative way, but I open my eyes and I see all of these people who have said and who have voted for policies to keep government out of their lives, who are now asking for government to be in their lives.
Well, how are things on campus right now?
Well, on campus, we haven't had a raise. I think it'll be almost 6 years this coming year. We've lost a lot of faculty members. We've lost deans. We've lost administrators. But we're hopeful that things are going to get better. We're starting with a new president, started just last week or the beginning of last week. So we're hopeful that things will get better, but we're not where we were just 6 years ago when we had made it into the top tier university status. And I don't know to what extent we're going to be able to get that right now, because all of the indicators that move you into top tier status are no longer our indicators.
Why is LSU falling down the ladder?
Well, primarily budget cuts, lack of getting raises. But the budget cuts are the main things. When you cut the budget, you are cutting from the meat of the university. You're cutting programs. We're having to do much more with less, and that would tend to impact morale. So those people who are getting invitations to move on, scientists, researchers, excellent teachers, are moving on. We've lost several chancellors and vice chancellors. I should say associate vice chancellors and vice chancellors, mm-hmm. Chief of finance, our chief budget officer. And I can't tell you their personal reasons for leaving, but those of us who are remaining there because I'm going to be there for sure. Teaching is my heart. Sure, I would like to get another raise. I don't want to go another 10 years without getting a raise. But when I look at young faculty, and I do my darndest to talk to junior faculty in my department to talk about the types of students we have, and they are excellent students, and how much gratification they will get from working with those students and still be able to do their research, i.e. stay here, don't leave. We are a great school. So it's a confluence of things that will determine whether people stay or whether LSU will be able to get more funding in the future and be able to stop cutting programs.
297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation with Professor Jinx Coleman Broussard. Though African Americans have served as foreign reporters for almost two centuries, the work remains virtually unstudied until now. Dr. Jinx Coleman Broussard has produced a compelling book, African American Foreign Correspondence, A History. And it is a rich history, isn't it?
It is certainly a rich history. I had no idea when I started on this journey that I would learn about so many intrepid, daring, courageous, talented black men and women, and at least one white woman who wrote foreign correspondence from abroad for publication at home. It has been a fascinating journey because every one of the individuals about whom I wrote made major contributions as they tried to change the status quo in the United States and to impact global policies abroad.
Tell us about William Worthy Jr.
William Worthy Jr. was quite a person. In fact, he's one of the people I felt most connected to while writing the book. I even had a chance to meet him in 2008 when he was in the early stages of Alzheimer's. He was being honored at Harvard University for the work that he had done in journalism. And I asked him, Mr. Worthy, why did you do the kinds of things that you do? And I'll tell you what some of those things were in a minute. And he said, to change the status quo.
He did that. He helped transform the role of modern foreign correspondents, gaining the right for journalists to report from anywhere in the world. How did he do it?
He challenged the United States travel ban that barred journalists from traveling to countries with which the United States did not have a good relationship. Right in the middle of the Cold War, William Worthy sneaked into Russia and reported as a freelancer for CBS News. So he's defying the U.S. government in the name of press freedom because he believed that every individual had the right to know and that journalism was honor-bound to provide that information to people. In 1956, while he was a Newman Fellow at Harvard University, he arrived at his room and found a cable from Red China under his door. That was Christmas Eve. He quickly went to Logan Airport, hopped a plane, and arrived in China by Christmas Day. He was just one or two steps ahead of the FBI, and he reported from China for 46 days. He interviewed Premier Chu Enlai and other people. He interviewed American citizens. He interviewed an American prisoner of war. So he was providing information that the United States did not want publicized, again, defying the U.S. government. When he arrived back in the United States, the U.S. had tried to confiscate his passport in Vienna and several other places. But this guy was almost like a private eye because he was able to evade the U.S. So what the U.S. did was took him to court. The United States government also confiscated his passport. But that did not prevent William Worthy from traveling. He went to Cuba against the wishes of the United States and reported on Fidel's overthrow of Batista.
We'll talk more with Jinx Coleman Broussard. Her book is African American Foreign Correspondence. It highlights remarkable individuals, including Mr. Worthy, and publications that brought an often overlooked black perspective to world reporting. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. CB for Gunston, Capital Watcher, is next. But we continue for a few more minutes with Jinx Coleman Broussard. Dr. Broussard is the author of African-American Foreign Correspondence from LSU Press. And she was detailing the remarkable life of one William Worthy Jr. And there are some others, including a professor of journalism at the University of Illinois, Leon Dash. How significant was he among his peers?
Leon Dash was definitely significant among his peers. He was an award-winning reporter, but before he became an award-winning reporter, he had trekked around the jungles of Africa as Angola tried to wrest itself from the yokes of colonialism under Portugal. And Leon Dash wrote a tremendous number of stories about the quest of those guerrillas to gain freedom for their country.
And then there's a gentleman who's also a journalism professor from Columbia, Howard French.
Right. Howard French was a reporter for the New York Times and for several decades. And when I interviewed Howard French, I wanted to know from both Howard French and Leon Dash whether they were reporters first or whether they were black reporters. And interestingly enough, and I also wanted to know to what extent did race govern their reporting? And even though Leon Dash started off by reporting on Africa, he told me that he was a reporter first, always interested in gathering the news. Howard French also said, yes, I'm a reporter, but I think I hold a privileged position as an African-American foreign correspondent to not only report on what is transpiring, but to look for the other side of the story. And he was talking about Africa. So he reported on the chaos and the corruption, the carnage in Africa. But he also looked for those stories that portrayed the kind of Africa he knew while he had lived there as a young man. And those were stories about the everyday things, about the art, the music, the festivals, just the everyday life of ordinary African people. So he used his perch to do the objective reporting, but he also looked for the other side of the story, because as he indicated to me when he went to the New York Times, he didn't want to be pigeonholed into what he called the black ghetto. And that was where the correspondents, the newspapers, sent their black reporters to Africa and to black countries. So he said, I don't want to go there. But where did he go? He was sent to the Caribbean. And he said if there was any place that was thought of as less than to these media people, it was the Caribbean. But he made a name for himself there and soon went off to Africa where he reported those kinds of stories.
All right. So here's a question from Allison related to the topic, localizing it. She asks about minority representation at the Baton Rouge Advocate. Do we have a writing crew there that is reflective of the population at large?
Well, I primarily teach journalism at LSU, and I have not kept track on staffing at the Advocate. I know at least four people who work at the Advocate. I don't know the total number.
Four
African-Americans who work at the Advocate. One gentleman is, I think, assistant managing editor at the Advocate, Johnny Butler. So to answer the question, I can't wax eloquently on that because I don't know the staffing at the Advocate.
What about the Picayune?
The Picayune has undergone such tremendous changes in the last 2 years. I do believe that its reporting staff might have been reflective of the population, but again, I have not kept track on statistics of that nature.
Well, I would imagine that, we have a state that's almost a third African-American. The student body at LSU, particularly in journalism, is not one-third African-American, is it?
No, it isn't. It's about 12%. And, Andrea, don't cut my head off if I have that percentage wrong. But I will tell you that we make concerted efforts in the Manship School. And just to give you one statistic, Jim, in terms of faculty, The Manship faculty has 3 African-American faculty members, and we are all we are all associate professors. So we make a concerted effort. I have served on virtually every search committee that the Manship School has had. And I've also aggressively recruited in New Orleans to try to interest young African-Americans to come to the Manship School, telling them not only will they come there and get a top-notch education, but they will also get mentoring. I serve as advisor to the Association of Black Communicators on campus, and I work very, very closely with those students.
Roy on Drusilla. Roy, please be brief. You're on with Jinx Coleman-Broussard.
Yes, I just want to thank the guests for being on the show. I wonder if you could comment about the importance of the president's trip to Africa.
What about the president?
I think the president's trip to Africa is extremely significant. It is time that the United States begin to get more of a foothold and get more involved in Africa. The gentleman I just talked about, Howard French, has written a lot about how the Chinese government is getting a foothold in Africa. As President Obama said, we don't want to just continue giving to Africa. We want to be able to help Africans become more independent and more self-sufficient. So I dare say that that trip is as necessary as the president's trip to Germany or to England to build better relationships and to provide some hope for the African people that things can get better in their continent, to encourage them to take action to become self-sufficient as we provide the kinds of support services and the kind of aid that China is investing in Africa.
Well, thank you. Jinx Coleman-Broussard. Dr. Broussard is quite a teacher. What are you teaching this semester?
I'm going to teach 2 public relations classes. I teach public relations campaign.
Will be in the fall?
In the fall, yes. The capstone PR course, and I'll teach public relations cases also.
And our latest work from LSU Press is African-American Foreign Correspondence, and she is previously the author of Giving a Voice to the Voiceless for Pioneering Black Women Journalists. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jim, for having me. It's been quite a pleasure.
My pleasure. And we're joined now by C.B. Fragonston, Capitol watcher like few others, and fervent blogger for more than a decade. He was first in his class about blogging about Louisiana politics, he and John Copes. And he is still doing his thing at Fragonston.com. Good morning to you, C.B. Fragonston.
Morning, Jim. Appreciate you having me on again.
Always good to talk with C.B. Well, do you have your big boy pants on today?
I like to think that I put them on every day, but they may not be big enough for Bobby Jindal.
Well, it's time to stop the bedwetting and put on your big boy pants.
Stop
the navel gazing. Do you do a lot of navel gazing, CB?
No, I've not done that either. I thought that was especially of the Jindal administration, actually, and I was surprised to hear that he thought that was some kind of a pejorative.
Well, we've had several people comment about the governor's words in Politico, and most on this show have said they don't think the governor really wrote that essay, including Jeffrey Sado, who is the number one Jindal fan, the professor of political science at the University LSU at Shreveport. But I think he did write it. I don't think a speechwriter would write something like that and allow it to go through to the masses.
Well, I believe that if he didn't write every word of it, he certainly instructed whoever wrote it to write it to certain specifications. I mean, who in the world would write a column and sign their name to it, or who would have somebody else write a column and sign their own name to somebody else's work and, you know, not approve of it? So, you know, if Bobby Jindal didn't actually type the words himself, I suspect that it does reflect his point of view, and even if it didn't, we're entitled to assume that, and because of the fact that he put his name on it and seems very proud of it. He spread it around.
Well, like a lot of brilliant people, as Governor Jindal is, he thinks outside the box, and sometimes that gets brilliant people in some trouble when they start writing about what they're thinking, and the governor has done this before. I suspect, CB, that he regrets writing an essay about exorcism, for example. Earl Long said, don't say what you can write, don't write what you can wink, or I'm paraphrasing him, but those words can come back to haunt you, can't they?
I think they can, and, you know, I'm not sure whether he's thinking out of the box or in an isolation, maybe just the opposite. Maybe the box that he's in is too small. He surrounds himself with very few people, a very limited number of people. It might be wrong to call it surrounded because I'm not even sure there's enough people to surround him that he confides in. And so when you start taking advice from a limited number of people, you tend to make mistakes, particularly when you're a high-profile public figure such as a governor of any state. I mean, the most successful business people I know who have, they are just as egotistical and hard-headed as Bobby Jindal, but they're intelligent enough to surround themselves with people who offer differing points of view, and they're willing to accept those people that disagree with them, although publicly they may not support the same ideas, that at least the person who surrounds himself with intelligent people tends to come out with a better conclusion. Bobby Jindal is just the opposite. Not only does he surround himself with very few people, but anybody that tells him anything that he doesn't want to hear is quickly dismissed. And so he's only getting one side of each issue. And I think the same thing is happening to him in the legal area where he is, or the state is losing all these lawsuits on matters that he jammed through the legislature in 2012 regular session. I think it's purely as a result of surrounding himself with not the best legal talent, but the most loyal legal talent. And so it's just he's an isolation person, and to say that he thinks out of the box, I think is just the opposite.
To the phones we go with C.B. for Gunston, 877-217-5757, wherever you are, for the man who is a lawyer now in Tangipo Parish and for many years was providing legal wisdom to lawmakers at the Capitol, and we go to HB for CB. HB, good morning. HB in Denham Springs.
Good morning. Mr. CB, my question is very simple. How can the legislators individually or collectively really look at themselves in the mirror and like what they see with the film credits and all the other credits that are given, tax breaks to the industry? When, like Mr. Jim's previous guest just said, education and health care suffering so bad in this state. Thank you, sir.
HB, that's an excellent question, and I don't know how they look themselves in the mirror, but they're great at rationalizing things. And when, again, because that they tend to flock together, speaking of legislators, they tend to prop each other up, and they say, well, they rationalize by saying this is the best we can do under the circumstances, and there are just no principles involved. There are a few principled legislators, but they don't get a lot done, and so I think it's just a lot of rationalization, and again they tend to be boxed in too and not going out, spending more time talking with their constituents.
297-5633 is your number. One thing is for certain, this is Governor Jindal's last term for a while as governor of Louisiana, and CB made a major announcement yesterday, and we'll find out what he did, but let's go to Bruce and Walden. Bruce, good morning. You're on with CB.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Yeah, I just read Tom Aswell's latest and greatest muckraking column showing once again the ties to ALEC, and I was wondering if your guest could comment on the ALEC control of the playbook for Jindal.
Well, I really can't. I'm not a believer in that there's some control factor out there, shadow government or whatever. I just don't believe in those things. And so it's hard for me to comment on this ALEC phenomenon. To me, it's right up there with black helicopters. I think there are a lot of explanations for why Jindal does what he does, but to trace it back to some group like ALEC or the Republican Party or anything, I think it's just difficult for me to get my mind around it.
Well, one of those who was considered to be a strong candidate for governor in 2015, 2 years from now, was the Agriculture Commissioner, Mike Strain, who twice has been elected. And a few days ago at the Farm Bureau Convention, Mike Strain made an announcement, and here's what he said.
And I can tell you that the vast majority of my friends, my supporters, my confidants, and the people that I know and trust have asked me not to run for governor, but to run again for commissioner.
All right, so he's not running for governor. And yesterday, CB, on the heels of Mike Strain's announcement, you made an announcement.
Well, let me explain. I didn't know Mike Strain was running for governor, so I was kind of taken aback by the fact that he announced he wasn't running. And that caused me to think, what if I don't make an announcement and there are people thinking out there that I'm running for governor? And, you know, that may put some people on the sidelines. I want my friends and family and numerous supporters out there to feel free to get behind a good candidate for governor. So, you know, following Dr. Strain's announcement, I felt it was necessary for me to say something, but I'm not quite ready to say it yet, even on your show today, Jim. What I announced yesterday was that I am going to give very prayerful consideration, after talking with all my many supporters, families, and friends.
You mean many families? Is there something about
many? Yeah, my many family members. Sorry, to discuss what I should or should not run for in the future. And I'm not prepared to say what I'm not going to run for, but I'm going to consider everybody's views. I'm not like Bobby Jindal. I'm going to do like Dr. Strain.
You are praying about this, right?
I am praying about it. Yes, I think that's the only thing you can do properly in politics. And I'm going by the masters. I mean, most of them pray about these things. And so I think that maybe I'll get some divine wisdom. And when I know, Jim, you'll know.
Okay, so C.B. Fragonston is praying about whether he should make the announcement that he is not running for governor. We'll hear.
And Jim, I would encourage everybody to do that, including yourself. You're a very high-profile public figure. And if you don't give some consideration to what you're not running for, there's going to be a lot of people sitting back waiting for you to announce that you are running.
We'll be back with CB in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org for CB for Godston. We will return to the phone lines in a moment, but Jason writes, hi, CB. I saw on your blog this morning that you're contemplating not running for something. I congratulate you on your honesty. So already there is a groundswell for you not running for something. So,
Jim, I think there is more interest than you know in me not running. I've had lots of suggestions that I not run. In fact, a journalist wrote me yesterday from New Orleans that she strongly suggested I not run for lieutenant governor because I would not be good for tourism.
Rancy in Millerville. Hi, Rancy. You're on with CB.
Yes, I would like to cast my vote for Mr. Fragonston, whether he runs or not. Thank you.
All right. For what?
That is my first vote ever. I appreciate that.
You know, I remember Reg Murphy. I think his name was Reg Murphy. He was the editor of the Atlanta Journal. Then it was the Atlanta Journal. And when Jimmy Carter announced he was running for president, they ran a banner headline that read, "Jimmy Carter is running for what?" So, you know, you have had some fun at the expense of Governor Jindal about his presidential ambitions, but I think this guy's got a shot, CB.
Jim, for what?
To be elected president of the United States, yes.
Sure, anybody can qualify to run for president, Jim.
You got to be 35. You got to be natural born.
He meets all the minimum qualifications, and I am convinced, despite what some people say, that he was born in Baton Rouge, not in India. So I think he meets all the qualifications necessary to be president of the United States, except that he has no prayer. I mean, people know who he is, and I give you and many others in the media credit for explaining to those outside of Louisiana who he is. And pretty obvious that everybody in Louisiana has now figured out who he is, since he only has about a 30% favorable rating.
Well, some would say it's a fluke that anybody gets elected president. Look at how President Obama won. But on the other hand, if you've got the requisite abilities and background, which I think the governor has, he has probably as good a shot as just about anybody else right now. Now, there are probably 15 other people who have as good a shot as Bobby Jindal, so let's say his chances are 1 in 15, but that's not bad.
Well, I would say that anybody that is even mentioned as president of the United States by other people being president is in a rare category. But frankly, what Bobby doesn't have is he doesn't have the mainstream Republican support that's necessary. And there are too many people ahead of him that don't have his baggage. And his baggage first comes with the national Republicans, is his inability to speak to the public, and that's a key ingredient. You know that as a communicator yourself. Now, I don't think we've ever had a president, at least not in modern times since the advent of television campaigns, that couldn't relate to the public through the media. And Bobby Jindal simply can't do that, and he cannot think on his feet. That's why he can't answer questions. I can't imagine him being in a position of running for president and being on his private airplane and numerous media people on there constantly coming up to him, asking him really significant policy questions, and him not being able to whip out a 3x5 card and parrot an answer to him.
Well, if he were to run for U.S. Senate next year on his way to the White House, I think he would have a good shot of winning.
Now, I disagree. I think he's finished politically in Louisiana. I mean, he might could make a runoff with Mary Landrieu, but then, you know, I think that's about all. But I'm not even sure he can do that. I don't understand the purpose of this, and I'm not quite sure why John McGinnis suggested this. I think all Bobby Jindal is doing by allowing this idea that he would run against Mary Landrieu to go forward is to help Mary Landrieu by putting on hold, and that's the reason I feel the need to announce what I'm not running for, because his supporters are on hold, particularly the big money people are saying, well, you know, I can't give to Cassidy because I'm afraid that if Bobby gets in, you know, I'll need to give to him because he's my friend or he's done a lot for me or whatever. So I just think that the only thing that is going on with this even discussion of Bobby Jindal running against Mary Landrieu is to hurt Congressman Bill Cassidy.
297-5633, and certainly we invite any comments from those who are supportive of the governor, who I think is an extremely bright man. But Janet writes, Governor Jindal is not brilliant. He is a talented man, talented in regurgitating facts for his own spin, and talented in surrounding himself with those of limited scope of knowledge or history. CB, your comments.
Well, I think he's highly intelligent. I think you and I would agree on that, Jim. I mean, you don't get to be a Rhodes Scholar with a lack of intellect. where I think that I would describe Bobby Jindal is that he's not smart. And smart is, there are a lot of smart people and people that I would consider brilliant who have no real formal education or nothing beyond high school. And that comes with learning from life and learning by experience. And so Bobby Jindal, I think, lacks that kind of world experience. And so I think he's highly intelligent, but not very smart.
297-5633 for CB for Gadsden. Now, he, the governor, wrote a letter to the editors of several newspapers last week and got it printed, as it should, saying that he was not the Scrooge that he was being made out to be, cutting the budget for funding with people with developmental disabilities. Yesterday on this show, his fellow Republican, Senator Dan Clater, disagreed with the governor's perception of what has happened. What's your assessment, CB?
Well, I agree. I didn't hear all of Senator Clater's comments, but I heard a quote that was widely circulated about, you know, going after the handicapped folks. And I agree with him. And Bobby Jindal can put all the spin on it. He does the same thing with colleges, you know, talking about, well, I hadn't really cut them. I just reduced the amount that everybody else wanted to give them. And that's just simply not true. I mean, Bobby Jindal, I don't understand why somebody with his intellect would think the rest of us are so dumb that we can't look this up. And it's not algebra. It's math. It's arithmetic to just look up and see what the funding was at one time and what it is today. And he just grabs things out of thin air, and he you know, if he ever became a high-profile candidate for the U.S. Senate or president, he would be destroyed with this kind of just factual inaccuracy. And that, and I appreciate Senator Clater for being willing to tell it like it is.
Well, sometimes a candidate can be destroyed by the facts, but then still win an election, CB. It's usually, unfortunately these days, it's more about other things rather than positions or facts or what have you. It's about how they present themselves and what kind of support base they have and how much money they raise.
Well, let's go back to the Bobby Jindal-Kathleen Blanco race, the first time Bobby Jindal ran for political office. And
yeah, by the way, 10 years ago, this is the 10th anniversary.
Very miraculous that he made it as far as he did. But what ultimately brought him down was this seeming hard edge towards the those people who have any kind of handicaps, mental, physical, or whatever. And I think that resonates with the public. We don't, you know, we want cuts, even us, all us fiscal conservatives, we want cuts and things like that. But we're not hard-hearted enough to want to take it out on the people who are simply not in a position to help themselves. And that just doesn't resonate well with the public. And I can see just these cuts that he's made just for the developmentally disabled, plus the cuts to higher education. I would just hammer him if he ever got in a race with another candidate over that.
Will there be a veto session?
No, this, you know, I had a friend of mine the other day say thought that this was a, you know, a lot of reaction to these cuts and everything, and I said, yeah, there's a lot of reaction compared to the norm, which is no reaction, but it's really not even close to being a groundswell. And I talked to a lobbyist that I have great respect for, who pretty plugged in all over the state, and he said the anger over these cuts is fairly limited to southeast Louisiana. Now, that's where most of the people are, but you're not hearing the same thing in north Louisiana and southwest Louisiana. So it's just not going to happen, and it's not happened since we put this automatic veto session in the current Constitution in 1974.
Are you going to take advantage of tax amnesty, CB?
No, Jim, I mistakenly paid all my taxes on time, but I am going to give prayerful consideration to not paying my taxes on time in the future, because we'll have this tax amnesty plan. And when the interest rates go up, which they will eventually as the national economy improves, I would be better off to leave my money in the bank drawing interest and then later wait for the next governor to get desperate for money. It might be 10 years, and then I'll come up, I'll pay my taxes then after getting 10 years worth of interest when they waive the interest and penalties. Because right now we're doing it at least every 10 years, and right now we're doing it after 4 years.
Well, the
I don't encourage people to pay their taxes.
What would happen if the federal government decided on a tax amnesty plan?
Oh, well, that would even be better because I pay a lot more to the federal government. If they started a, you know, a routine amnesty plan, Jim, it's just bad public policy. You know, to do it once every 20 or 30 years might be worthwhile, but you know, you look at all the taxes that are owed and you say, oh, we can get billions of dollars in. Well, I prefer to do it the old-fashioned way, and you go collect the taxes, and if you have to sue people, you sue people like the new collection agency, State Treasurer John Kennedy got behind and my representative Chris Broadwater passed this session. But the idea of an amnesty plan, just a lazy man's way of collecting what's due. And frankly, when you look at all those taxes, it looks like a lot of money, but you're going to find that most of those people have died, have their businesses, their corporate entities that no longer exist, and there are no assets to seize. And so there's nobody going to come forward and you know, come up with $1 billion in taxes.
I think it's Marika. She asks if you have taken the Grover and Norquist pledge, CB.
No. You know, I'm now referring to Grover as Pope Grover Norquist with a little p, because he seems to have the ability to absolve people from taxation by merely saying that it's not a tax. I read James Gill's article and an enforceable obligation is not a tax. And I question whether Gill has checked with Pope Norquist to make sure that that's the situation, because apparently only Grover Norquist, who I think lives around Washington, D.C., knows what a tax is. And, you know, I've tried to do some research on it, and I have some ideas, but it really doesn't make any difference. It's whatever Pope Norquist says.
Well, who's following him?
Apparently Bobby Jindal, but I really would encourage Pope Norquist to take a closer look at Bobby Jindal's record, because I actually believe he's violated it. Even if you don't want to call tuition increases taxes, there was at least a driver's license tax that was passed under Bobby Jindal, and nobody talks about that. So he's not pure either. Only Grover Norquist is pure.
Well, what about this pension reform development? There was a court ruling Friday. What do you think?
I think the court ruling was absolutely correct, and the only thing that bothers me about this thing is that the speaker ruled so erroneously in light of the facts that it only required a majority vote instead of a two-thirds vote, and I expected it to be slapped down. And, you know, the big thing about this, almost all of Bobby Jindal's big reforms during the 2012 legislative session, by the way, this was the only pension reform bill that passed despite him announcing that in 2012, and it was struck down. So, you know, and it's interesting. Pension reform was really important in 2012, and it's not important anymore, and it's not been fixed. But Bobby Jindal continues to insist on passing unconstitutional legislation because he just believes that he can force his will on the courts. And I'm not a big fan of courts and judges, despite being a lawyer, but I have to admire the Supreme Court for standing up to him. He may be the first governor in modern times in Louisiana that the Supreme Court has actually ruled against a sitting governor.
Who's the last governor you liked in Louisiana?
Uh, Well, I like John McKithen. I've liked all the governors, including.
Well, no, you like their policies.
No, as far as a policy, I thought John McKithen had excellent economic development policies, and had that we kept going in that direction, and that's primarily from his first term. His second term was a little different, but his first term, I really think he set us on the right track, and we just got off track since.
Well, and we've had six governors since then, and CB has been a critic of all of them on occasion, and we thank you for your thoughts and comments today. Happy holiday to you, CB.
You too, Jim.
Thanks. Take care. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.